Tonight I have the distinct pleasure of introducing our main speaker, and just so everybody knows, he will be behind this podium. However, he is wearing black Nike short socks with his suit. That is a faux pas. Seriously, Michael has been very influential in my sobriety, and I know he's been very influential in many others' sobriety. He was one of the many that intimidated me when I got here, and later I found out that we were all just on the same page and that we were all on the same level. I'm very grateful to have Mike in my life as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and with that I'd like to have you welcome him up.
Hi everyone, my name is Mike Heitland, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mike!
And I'm sober since September 18th of 1996. Faux pas, that's not a word I hear very often. I do have Nike socks on tonight. I thought it was, I'm a nerd, I can't help it. I'm not very classy a lot of times. In fact, I'm rarely very classy. I try to look it each week, but underneath there's 100% nerd here, so... it's the truth. I make jokes with people nowadays, and they're not funny. People don't laugh at me. I send email jokes out, and they come back with, "Are you stupid?" So every once in a while, I'll get someone that gets it. But I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to come speak at my home group tonight. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I absolutely love the Northern Plains group. I'm not going to spend a lot of time today talking. I know a lot of people say that, and then they spend the whole hour talking about it. But I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about my birthplace and all that, and where I grew up and where I attended school, because I don't think it's necessarily why I became alcoholic. In fact, I think a lot of times I've been led when I was early in sobriety to believe that when people would speak. So I'll tell you that I was born in Minot, North Dakota. Now we're talking. See, I've never understood that. Why, no matter where anyone says they're from, everyone boos. I mean, if I was born in Ireland. What's up? Ireland rocks! So I'm not all up on the booing. I'm actually, you know, a little round of applause. You know, that whole town endured me for quite a while. So I was born in Minot, North Dakota. And now we're talking. That's what I'm talking about. I quickly moved to Ackley, Iowa, where I spent the first 10 years of my life. I grew up on a farm. In fact, Kirsten last week, she was talking about growing up on a pig farm. And I grew up on a pig farm. I rode pigs. I waded through knee-high crap and lost my boots all the time. I mean, I grew up on a pig farm. I was a farm boy. For those of you that are farm people, you end up being rather sheltered if you live on a farm growing up. So... my parents are good people. They're not alcoholic. They've got their own issues, but they are definitely not alcoholic. They didn't abuse me. They didn't beat me. They didn't kick me or hurt me. They gave me a lot of the things that I wanted, and for the most part, everything I needed. So I don't believe that my alcoholism has anything to do with where I was raised or my parents or the fact that I've got Irish in me. I think though I was born endowed with a great amount of alcoholic tendencies. In fact, I would kind of consider myself a freeze-dried alcoholic. And once alcohol hit me, that was all it took. I was out of the gates. So I left Ackley, 9 years old, and I came to Minot. And in Minot, everyone was doing things differently than you do in Iowa. In Iowa, you know, we have hay rides, and. You can pick up a roasted chicken at the market. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot to do in Ackley, Iowa. Population 1,000, you know, two hours from any large city. My mom and dad were farmers. They weren't into technology. The best thing they ever bought me, though, for those who are out there that understand this, they bought me a Commodore VIC-20. Yeah, I love Commodore VIC-20s. And that was what I had. That was my game system. So when I came to mind, I was at least somewhat in tune with what people are talking about. You know, video games were cool. We didn't have video games in Ackley. We had a pinball machine at the market. So I didn't really fit in with other kids. You know, they were talking about all sorts of things that I didn't really understand. I didn't grasp. And I was a very antisocial kid. I know sometimes I might try to give the perception today that I'm an extrovert or someone that, you know, talks really well and is shaking everyone's hands. But on the inside, I'm absolutely terrified most of the time. And I grew up that way. I didn't meet a lot of people. I didn't have a lot of friends. I was that quiet guy in the corner that was secretly plotting everyone's death. I was the kind of guy where in school, if my pencil broke, it was a life-altering decision, absolute life-altering decision, if I was to get up in front of the class and go sharpen my pencil. Well, you know, when you do that, you have to walk from here to there, and the entire time you're walking that way, everyone's eyes are on your back. You know? I mean, you just, everyone, they're staring at you. So I didn't feel very comfortable growing up. I had a temper issue. That might be Irish. I have no clue. I had an anger issue, you'd call it. I got mad instantaneously for absolutely no reason. My mom's house looked like Swiss cheese. I had so many holes in the wall for my fist. When I was 11, I got disgruntled and I took a butcher knife after my brother and tried laying it inside of his head. I just missed and caught the wall, and my aunt came over, pinned me down, and sent me off to Jamestown Psychiatric Unit. So, at age 11, I adopted the nickname Mike the Psych. You know, Psycho Mico, and they go on and on. Yeah, it was pretty sad. So I was kind of branded at that time as the crazy kid. I loved using that to my advantage. I didn't get in a lot of fights in the early years of high school because all you had to do was act crazy, and people didn't want to fight you. You know, you punch someone really hard, and you freak out on them, and you knock them around a bit, and everyone thinks, "Geez, that Mike's tough." Scared as hell is what I was. You know, scared as hell. Just make sure you land those punches, and you know, and try to act tough. So I distanced people as much as I could. I've always been afraid to let people inside, let people really know what I'm like, because I was absolutely sure that if I told people or let people know who I was, they wouldn't like me. I mean, I know what I am. I'm a frightened, I'm a scared, insecure, inadequate person, and that's the way I felt my entire life. Something happened. As I said, I was a freeze-dried alcoholic. Sometime around age 14, I got the opportunity to drink. I can't tell you the first time I drank liquor. I know there was a lot of occasions where I drank liquor, but I can tell you the first time I recall today getting drunk. I had an opportunity to go out. There was this girl that I lusted after, I had this crush on her. It was terrible, and I didn't get the picture. I was pretty stupid too. I didn't get the picture. She had a boyfriend who was a wingnut. Forgive me for those who are in the Air Force. Whatever. leave it to Ryan. He was in the Air Force, and he was old enough to buy liquor, and they bought me a bottle of Smirnoff vodka, and I proceeded to lay down in this bed and drink vodka like it was water. And I tell you what, when you don't have an alcohol tolerance, it's not even 15 minutes before I'm starting to slur, and I couldn't crawl out of bed, and I was like, they were dragging me to use the bathroom, you know, this girl that I like's holding me up while I pee. I just, but you know what, that night it was awesome. It was awesome. I was like, I can't even pee by myself. I was just so proud. So proud. The next day, I was mortified. You know, I was embarrassed. But that night, I was just the coolest guy. And these people that were in the air, you know, I'm sure they were shooting me funny looks like, who is this dweeb? But I felt like I was part of that group. I felt like I fit in. And I'm imagined that she really liked me a lot. But that was the first time I really recall alcohol doing something for me and to me. Man, I love what alcohol does for me. Alcohol is the second best solution I know to alcoholism. Man, I drink some liquor and a sense of ease and comfort the book describes comes over me. In fact, I'm almost inclined to believe that I don't have to get the liquor in my system before that sense of ease and comfort starts to come, because I know what's going to come. Before I sobered up, my hangout was this little bar called the Roundup. Corey knows. The Roundup, yeah, it was a dive. It was a hole in the wall, but they sold Coronas for $2 a pop, and I like that. The bartender there was a grave kind of an alcoholic. I don't think he's sober if he's even alive. But, you know, we clicked, and I drank there a lot. But I remember when I'd walk into the beer, it was kind of like Cheers, or walk into the bar, it was kind of like Cheers. I'd walk in there, and the first thing you do would put out two Coronas for me. And I'd pound the first Corona. I swear, I felt comfort as that first Corona started going in. Now, I know scientifically the alcohol had not reached my head in great enough proportion for me to feel that sense of ease and comfort. But I knew what was coming down the pipe. You know, I knew. I knew that in a few minutes, I'm going to be able to sigh that breath of relief, and I'm going to be on my way. And that's what alcohol does for me. I am mortified, in pain, just absolute pain to walk around amongst other people because I'm just so insecure and so self-centered. And but man, you get some liquor in me, it doesn't change much of the self-centeredness, but I'm comfortable. I am comfortable, and I absolutely enjoy drinking. Unfortunately for me, consequences come as a result of it. You know, I didn't get in trouble the first time I got in trouble the first time I drank, but I didn't get in trouble right away. I mean, I was one of those guys that I enjoyed drinking, and, you know, we were careful about it. We'd plan out our weekend, and we'd make sure we went and got drunk places so that we wouldn't get caught and stuff growing up. And, you know, every once in a while we'd get busted or whatever, but it was never anything terrible. But around age 18, things started spiraling out of control. I was in my fifth year of high school. Because I don't like doing homework, I don't like listening to teachers, and I don't like having to do anything anyone tells me. So I was in my fifth year of high school, and I was attending a place called Sarasota River Campus, which is it's an alternative school. I'm sure a lot of people are aware of what that is. It's where people like me go when you can't sit through class without getting in a fight or swearing at the teacher or throwing a scene. And I graduated because I would get stoned every morning, and I would just stare at my homework, and I don't know how it got done, but I got done. I basically got stoned through class, and I managed to complete school when I was just turning 19 years old, and that year was terrible. I got in trouble with the police. I got in trouble at home. My mom and dad were just getting frustrated with me. Now, mind you, my parents had endured a lot by this time. You know, I said at age 11 I'd gone to the psych ward. That was my first trip to the psych ward. I made four other subsequent trips to different psych wards, along with a year and a half trip to Dakota Boys Ranch in Minot. So my parents were just, God, I really feel bad for what I put them through. You know, I really do. They endured a lot. And, I know there were nights my mom just cried herself to sleep. I was a really terrible son, and I didn't want to be a bad kid. I just couldn't handle being what they wanted me to be. I couldn't handle going to school and doing this good grade stuff and try to be Mr. Popular and playing sports. That took too much out of me, you know? So I was 19. I was miserable. I didn't know where to go. My parents were absolutely fed up with me. And around that time, I was introduced to cocaine. And I got to tell you, I'm a firm believer in talking Alcoholics Anonymous from the podium, but it's part of my story. I fell in love with cocaine. I love cocaine. Cocaine was another miracle thing. It allowed me to drink for a long time. It was good. I'm an alcoholic to the core. I could consider myself a junkie just the same, but I don't crave cocaine today. But I tell you what, when my first couple years of sobriety, there were days where I just thought about drinking. You know, it wasn't about, I'd like to go out and get myself some foil and smoke some cocaine. It was like, I'd like to go out and get drunk. I'd like to go out and get drunk right now and not have to deal with this. So cocaine really sped up the process. What I had for what I believed was manageable at the time quickly slipped off. I wasn't able to keep a job. Heck, I don't think I had a solid job that I stayed with that wasn't like one of those, you know, odd jobs. I'm going to do roofing for 3 days here, and then I'm going to go try this other construction job, and then they're going to kick me out and say, you can't come to work drunk like that, and you can't try to bury hammers in people's heads. You need to go over here. And I couldn't keep a straight job. I couldn't make any money. I was dealing dope at the time. I thought I was Mr. Big, you know. God, I thought I had everything figured out during the day anyway. At night, I'm the kind of guy that lays awake in bed, staring at the ceiling, plotting how I'm going to fix my life the next day. You know, I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine how many times I laid in bed thinking, you know, tomorrow I'm going to get up and I'm going to go get a real job and I'm not going to get drunk tomorrow morning. Nope, not even touching the bong in the morning. I'm going to get up and I'm going to go get a job and I'm going to attend that job. I mean, I'm going to work my butt off and I'm going to get some money. I'm going to pay off that fine that I've got a bench warrant for, and I'm going to go pay my mom back some money because she keeps heckling me. Maybe then she'll let me hang out in the house a little longer and she won't give me that look that she gives me, and I'll make her proud. You know, I really wanted to be a good person. I just man, when I need to get what I need to get, I cannot follow through with those kind of commitments. So, long story short, age 19 to 21 is a blur. It's an absolute blur. I could tell you a lot of funny stories. I don't want to tell too many of them. Matt H. And Kirsten H. live across the street. They live across the street from a trailer court that was known at the time to me as Mexiville. It's where a lot of Mexican families lived. And I remember when they bought the house. Actually, I was driving down the street. I'm like, oh my God, I remember this street. I used to go down to leave Minot and go down to Fargo and trade money and guns and stuff for dope. Right there across the street, like I think the same trailer. I can't remember the trailer because that was a blur, but I think it's the same trailer still there. And I sold drugs all the time. I have all sorts of great stories on how I made a mess of myself and OD'd and got in trouble with the law. I woke up one morning with a couch full of weapons that were stolen from some ex-Fed's house in Minot. I remember thinking, oh my God, how in the hell did these get here? I don't know what to do. Let's put it this way. I was very fortunate. My dad had a good lawyer. He ran for state's attorney. And the guy must have had some compassion. Whatever you give your lawyer at the beginning. It was like a $1,500 retainer fee or whatever. And I think that's all he ever charged me for helping me out of all the trouble I got in. But I never went to jail for it. A quick story before I get on to where I sobered up. Last week, I got a phone call, cell phone call, and I was sitting at my office doing my work, and a guy gets on the phone. He says, "Hi, Boy Gelgrud here." I'm thinking, Boy Gelgrud, who the hell is Boy Gelgrud? That name sounds so familiar. And it dawns on me, Boy Gelgrud, 10 years ago, I hung up the phone on him. I told him, do your own effing homework. And I thought, that's the detective that wanted to arrest me for those burglaries. Holy crap, why is he calling me? I kept thinking, my head starts spinning. I'm like, And this is all, I swear, it probably only took 3 seconds at best before I responded to him, but it seemed like an eternity. And it was like everything caught up. I'm thinking, that's it. The jig's up. 7 years sobriety. This is what the big book talks about. You got to pay the time for the crime. I'm going to have to go to jail. And I'm like, of course I remember you, Boyd. How you doing? It's like, I'm doing great. So I got your brother in the back seat here. And I'm thinking, he snitched? My brother. He snitched on me for something. But it turns out that Boyd is doing transport for the state now, and my brother, who is incarcerated, I love that word. My brother, who's incarcerated, was getting transported across the state. So anyway, I picked up some stuff. I shook hands with this guy that absolutely hated my guts, and I'm clean with that now. I had a chance to make some brief amends to him, so good thing. Anyway, yeah, it's awesome. So I'm 21 years old. I'm miserable, and I don't really know where to go anymore. And you know, I'm sure everyone's got a similar story. I was running out of areas. I was running out of places to go. I was running out of things to do. I didn't really know how to fix my life. And I woke up one morning, no different than any other morning, blackout drunk. Woke up in some closet, chairs wrapped around me, all messed up. Lost my dope. Lost my money. Seem to remember picking a fight with that guy at the bar, and. And I walked down the street because I didn't even know if I was in Minot anymore. I walked down the street and I recognized this professional building. I went in and made a phone call and told my brother to come pick me up. And when he shows up, he's like, dude, that's CDU. And I swear at the moment, as distorted as my perception was, it seemed like the rays of heaven, the clouds opened up and rays of light shone down. It was like, I need to go to treatment. Now, my thought was I need to get a handle on this drinking. In fact, I stopped by a friend's house and I said, Jeff, don't worry about it, Jeff. I tell you, I'm not going to quit smoking dope. I'm just going to get a handle on this drinking thing. And I swear to you, I meant it. I absolutely meant it. I honestly thought at that point that I could get a handle on my liquor. I could control it. I could manage it. I could deal with this not blacking out and getting in trouble and going to jail and so forth. And I went to treatment, and it's a mystery. I was talking to my mom. My mom worked at the hospital, so she's privy to my records, and she brought me in there. She brought me to treatment that day. I quit drinking that night, I don't know, midnight, 1, 2, something like that. But the next day when I went in around noon, I still had .03. I still was – so I know I was a walking liquor store. I was so sick and so miserable. They had me in Valium for a couple weeks, and I came to in a treatment center, and it dawned on me one day. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm in treatment. I'm in treatment. And I had to say that a couple times because I was sitting in a meeting, and I just kind of came to. And I thought to myself, you know – because I've been in treatment facilities, not CDU, but I've been in psych wards. I know how to play the game. I know how to, I see a light at the end of the tunnel. I think I'm going to be able to be okay now. You know, I know how to play these guys. But there was something going on. Apparently someone had gotten through to me, and I was really starting to contemplate the whole staying completely clean deal. That Saturday, the Minot Thursday group, which was my original home group in Minot, showed up to the doors, and Gerard T., rosy cheek and all, came in, goofy as hell, loved the guy to death. He came in, and that guy talked about how he felt. Now, in my circle of friends, old friends, mind you, we didn't talk about how we felt. It wasn't, you know, I woke up this morning feeling so remorseful and so insecure. I didn't know what to do, so I got on my knees and prayed. We didn't talk like that. That gets you beat up. But Gerard's up there talking like that. You know, some days I wake up just absolutely petrified, absolutely scared. I was just a locked on target. I listened to everything that guy had to say. And that night, you know, he just like we do at our meeting here, he approached me and he stuck his hand out and he suckered me into some coffee and told me he wanted to hang out with me. And I was game. I had nothing else to do. I had nowhere else to go. For the first couple months, Gerard drugged me around to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He drugged me around when I sobered up. To give you the visual, I had my sideburns had I had shaved down into blades that came down on my jaw, kind of Wolverine-ish, but really pointy. And this big goatee, and I had my hair was down to here, but it was cut like Jason Newsted, so it was a bowl cut, and it was ponytail, and I wore a drug rug all the time, and a bandana. And Gerard was a preppy boy. I mean, he was going to college. He looked clean cut. I can't imagine if people watched me and him walking into a store together, thinking, "What the hell do those two have in common?" But he was. He was dragging me after Burger King and meetings, and he was getting me involved with people. I remember I showed up at Ron R.'s house, and Ron R., a good member of AA at the time, said, "Hey, you know, come on in." And I was like, "Gerard, I can't go. I don't know this guy. I can't go into here." And he's like, "Dude, we're all friends here. Just come on in." He drugged me in and got me involved with the fellowship. And I think at that point I had really surrendered to almost everything. I'd surrendered to the idea that I'd have to take a job and work consistently. I'd surrendered to the idea that I was going to have to attend regular meetings, that I was going to have to meet with the sponsor, that I was going to have to do these steps. But something that I did not surrender, something that I couldn't surrender at the time, was my opinion. I wanted to believe that I was the smartest guy around. And when I think like that and think that I have the answers, I don't ask my sponsor for advice because I know the answer. And what happened is my sponsor said, "Mike, I don't think you should take that job out there working with those guys that smoke dope." And I said, "I'll be fine. I understand what you're saying. I really understand what you're saying, Gerard, but I need this job." And, you know, he shook his head. And what happened was I ended up using. I used this over and over again. And September 17th was it was a cold day out. I don't know why it was so cold, but we were moving the bee. I was a beekeeper. I'd come to meetings with my face half swollen. And I remember sitting in this vehicle, and I had gotten stoned I don't know how many days before. I was just miserable. I can't hold this thing together. I can't seem to stay sober. And I remember sitting in my vehicle, and I don't think I've shared this from the podium before, maybe a long time ago, but I remember sitting in that vehicle, and it was Rick and Chad, these two guys I worked with, and Rick was passing this bat down to Chad, and I thought, here goes again. I'm going to get stoned again. I'm going to regret it. I knew the cycle. I mean, it was plain as day to me. I'm going to use. I'm not going to get the effect that I want because I'm so agitated and so upset about not being able to stay sober that I'm going to be miserable the whole time and I'm going to be remorseful and I can't seem to break out of the cycle. And it came to Chad and I thought, well, here it goes. I don't know what hit my mind at that moment, but I put my hands together and I looked out the window and I looked up and I said a prayer. I said the third step prayer and I asked God to remove the obsession. And I have not had that obsession, that same obsession, ever since. I didn't need to use that day. I went to a roundup that weekend down here in Fargo, and I met up with some people that were just sick AA Nazis. They were all about AA, 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 AA. Bob R. brought me down, I believe, that time, left me down there alone. No, he didn't completely abandon me. I found a ride back. I got involved. I got involved. I don't know how else to put it. I started surrendering my opinion, too. I started saying, you're right, I probably don't have the best idea. I succumbed to the fact that I just don't make very good decisions when it comes to my life. I'm getting better at it, which is a good thing, but I still run everything by my sponsor. I remember telling my mom, too. My mom is not alcoholic, has no idea what I do in this program other than the fact that I'm sober and she absolutely loves you guys. But I was trying to tell her, I need to go buy that, but it's like $25. I'm going to call Gerard. You're going to call Gerard? I'm going to call Gerard. Why are you going to call Gerard? Well, because I need to know if I should buy this. She totally doesn't. You're going to ask your sponsor if you should go buy something. Well, yeah. When are you going to start making your own decisions? I'm thinking, this is a dangerous conversation for a guy like me. Sometime, Mom, sometime. And I need to scurry out of the room. But I got involved in AA. I got a job in my home group. I started hanging out with people. And eventually what happened is I got another sponsor. I got Jeff V, who I owe the man my life. He told me what I needed to hear when I needed to hear it and wasn't afraid of being an enemy in a sense. I mean, he wasn't about being my friend. He was about being my sponsor. And he laid down the smack, and he had the unique knack. I know a lot of people have said it. But he has a knack of telling me to go to hell, and I'm happy to go there. It's just like, thank you, Jeff. Thank you. I took his advice. His voice was stronger than my head, and that's exactly what I needed. I needed someone that could tell me what I needed to do and give me good descriptions of what I needed to do. Because left to my own devices, I'll twist whatever you tell me into whatever I want it to be. But he gave me descriptions that you do this, this, and this, and you say these things, and you'll be okay. And I did it. And my life started getting better. I ended up moving to Fargo in 99. I came down. The Northern Plains Group had been around for about 5-6 months, something like that. The group is small. This group is absolutely huge compared to what it was. I think there was 35 people back then, 45 people. It was so tiny. A newcomer would show up, and the whole, you know, circle is like vultures surrounding the new guy. You couldn't breathe, you know. It's like, let the guy breathe. But I got involved, and I moved down here, and I hooked up with the Northern Plains Group, and I'll be damned, you know. I've learned to take the principles that were given to me in the steps and in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and apply them in my life. I've been able to apply the traditions in my home life. I've been able to apply the steps and traditions in my work life. I kept a job for 3 years. I got a job at a computer place, and I didn't quit. It's amazing how long you can keep a job if you don't quit the minute you don't think things are going your way. And I showed up to work on time, and I shook people's hands, and I smiled a lot, and just, if I didn't have the answer, I said, I don't know. And I'll be damned, they kept me, and they promoted me, which was even more baffling. And that's what's worked. I've taken what I've learned in AA, and I've applied it everywhere that I can apply it. I'm open to trying all sorts of new things. I've been thinking about doing some Toastmasters. I might not seem it, but I'm petrified at being at the podium. I've never liked speaking in public. Never liked it one bit. I don't like the fact that everyone's paying attention to me right now. Most of you are thinking about yourselves, I know that, but you're looking up here anyway, so perception. But just a little bit about my life today. I'm happily married. I've got two beautiful children. I've got a roof over my head that's being paid for by a company that pays me more than I'm worth. I've got this relationship with God today that it's amazing. It's not always on target, and I'm not always plugged in. But today I have to say that God has absolutely blessed me. He's absolutely blessed me. I don't deserve what I have today. I really don't. I don't deserve it. If I got what I deserved, I'd be sitting in the pen. Me and Lee here, we'd be hanging out in the pen together. Because that's the kind of person I am. I lie, I steal, I cheat. You know, I'd sell the shirt off your back in front of you if I could. That's the kind of guy I am. But AA has taught me how to behave like a man and how to treat other people with respect and dignity. One of the valuable lessons I learned in AA was that you need to treat people with respect regardless of what you think of them. It's not about how I treat you, isn't about what I think of you. It's about who I am. And it took me a while to get that. You know, I used to, he's a pig. I don't like him. And I, you know, go around assassinating for the next 6 years and never want to make an amend. And today I've learned to shut your mouth. You know, talk to your sponsor about it. Talk to people that can help you through resentments and deal with it. And man, my life is different today. I wake up in the morning and I don't hate who I am. I go to work and I work with we have enough people in where I work upstairs to have a meeting every morning, a big meeting. And I work with a bunch of drunks and, you know, we don't throw fists up there, which is just absolutely amazing because there's a lot of alcoholism up there. I work with a great group of people. I've got people that I sponsor and I work with that keep me in line and hold me accountable just like my sponsor does. My sponsor today is Bruce E. out of Eau Claire. He told me to tell everyone hi. One more message. I got just before I spoke here tonight, I got a phone call from my little brother. He's in St. Cloud right now, ready to serve his time in Minnesota. He's got another year and a half sitting above his head. And he told me to tell all of you, I wanted so badly, it was out of place, so I couldn't do it, but he wanted so badly, I wanted to turn on the mic and let him speak into it here and tell everyone. He's like, tell them that it doesn't get any better on the other side. So I've done my part there. Today my God has got to be bigger than a doorknob. He's got to be stronger than my sponsor. My idea and concept of God today is a loving, caring, merciful God. I do not deserve what I have today, and it's only, I think, through his blessing, through mercy, and through grace that I have what I have. I don't deserve it. I'm not a wonderful man today. I'm still working on a whole different set of problems today. I've got the steps in my life. I've got the steps and traditions in my marriage. My wife's in Al-Anon. God bless Al-Anon. For those of you that sit around conferences, I know because I was one of you that sit around conferences and blackball Al-Anon. And I don't want to listen to Al-Anon speaker. They're going to get all cry. I got to tell you, man, Al-Anon works. My marriage has gotten so much better as a result of Al-Anon. I will never, ever speak another harsh word against Al-Anon. And for those of you that doubt, come talk to me. Al-Anon has got my utmost respect. I love the Northern Plains Group. I love all of you. I've got wonderful friendships and relationships today that I never would have imagined in my wildest dreams that I have. I can talk to people today about all sorts of fears and insecurities and I'm connected, you know. I'm really connected. I'm part of something so much bigger than myself that I can just be absorbed by. I've learned today I don't have to be the leader of anything. I can just be the little guy that runs around and does his little part, and I can be the middleman, you know. I don't have to be the big shot. I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Kenny for asking me to speak tonight. I've been dreading it for the last year. I thought I got out of it, but apparently I didn't. I'm really grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to God for the direction and wisdom that I've gotten through my from him through my sponsor, and I thank you so much. Thank you, AA, for my life.